Hi everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hi, everyone. My name is Brianna Contreras, and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast, Senior Editor of MHE, Peter Werwein, and I spoke with yet another editorial advisory board member, Meg Murray, founding CEO of the Association for Community Affiliated Plans, for a segment in our Meet the Board series. In the discussion, we got to explore Meg's journey in healthcare, learn more about her organization, and look into some of her views about the Biden administration's effects on healthcare, as well as the ACA's.
Hi, Meg. How are you doing today?
Good.
All right. Well, thank you for joining our monthly episode of the Meet the Board series on our Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast.
Happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. So first off, can you just tell our listeners and readers briefly, you know, about your career in healthcare and how it started?
Sure. My interest in healthcare started when I was fairly young because in my family, my father used to always talk about how his mother was sick when he was young and the family didn't have health insurance and the impact that that had on their family. So that was kind of why my interest started in the importance of health insurance. But in terms of my career, I started my career after college in state government in Massachusetts. I worked in the House Ways and Means Committee. And although I worked on revenue issues at the time, the issues in those years, it was when Dukakis was running for president, 1987, 88, in that time frame. Like today, the state government's budgets were being driven by Medicaid. And so I became very interested in Medicaid because of my interest in state government. Eventually, I made it my way to the federal level, and I worked at OMB and worked on the Medicaid managed care waivers, the 1115 process for OMB. And so that's really kind of was my path to healthcare.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thank you. And then what are your thoughts of the publication, you know, being a board member and just, you know, what are your thoughts about being on our board?
Yeah, it's a wonderful publication. I'm always interested to see. I love seeing the pieces written by individuals about their perspective. I think, had one published related to my time in Germany looking at the German healthcare system. So it's a wonderful publication and with good perspective across the spectrum of people and organizations that are involved in Medicaid managed care or managed care. But my particular interest, of course, is Medicaid managed care.
Right. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about how the Association for Community Affiliated Plans got started and what your role was and why is an association like this needed?
Sure. Well, we actually got started in the year 2000. So we just had our 20th anniversary, which, like so many others, we were not able to celebrate during COVID. We had planned on having a big celebration, but the organization got started in 2000 by a group of 14 community health center affiliated plans with some funding from HRSA. And they had come together because they were like-minded plans across the country. And they had incorporated before I came on board, but I was the first executive director because they all have day jobs and weren't able to move the association that much further. So that was the start, 14 plans, and now we're up to 78 plans. We've expanded over time to not be an association of just CHC affiliated plans, but all nonprofit plans that are focused on Medicaid.
How has the association changed and evolved over the years? And has the reason to be changed with the times, you know, if it's evolving? And then where do the plans that you represent fit into the health insurance sector?
So when we started, I mentioned that we were formed by the community health center plans, and they were only serving Medicaid clients at that time. But in 2006, with the implementation of the Medicare Modernization Act, the D-SNP program was established. And so our plans decided that they, many of them wanted to serve this population of dual eligibles. And so we expanded the work we were doing to include support for dual eligibles. And then with the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, the marketplace started. And so our plans, again, many of them decided for mission reasons, as well as to expand the base of their client base, essentially, to enter the marketplace. So today, of our 78 plans, about half of them serve dual eligibles in some fashion through DSNPs or the MLTSS program or the Duals Demo program. And about a quarter of them, one in four, serve in the marketplace. So that's really been the evolution in terms of the work that we do in terms of the lines of business. But the focus of ACAP and our plans has always been trying to improve healthcare for low-income people through the public managed care programs.
So for the next question, do you lobby, and as an organization and you personally, and if so, what is that like?
We as an organization, we have contractual relationships with two lobbyists, Rodney Whitlock at McDermott Plus and Bobby Clark at Pyxis. So we have a D and an R, and they do our official lobbying. We certainly go up on the Hill to educate members and their staff about our issues. And we have two fly-ins a year where we ask our members to come in and also go up and educate their members of Congress on the policies. And we find that people are always very receptive to the story we have to tell. We are big employers in each of the congressional districts. We actually just did a paper recently that looked at how many Medicaid beneficiaries are in each members of Congress district. And they were very interested in that data because people always want to know, you know, about the population of their district. And that is not typically collected in that way. So we were able to do some analysis to estimate how many people are in each members of Congress district. So we always want to come up and bring them something of interest to them. And then of course, tell our story and why we think it's important that Medicaid be protected and ideally expanded in the non-expansion states and make sure that people can stay on Medicaid for a full year.
And Meg, this is Peter. I would presume that Democrats are more receptive to your concerns and your agenda than Republicans, but that's an assumption on my part. Is it true?
It's not completely true. As hopefully many of your listeners know, we have been pushing for a policy of 12-month continuous eligibility in Medicaid. And that bill has always had a Republican co-sponsor. It was Representative Green from Texas initially. Today, it's Representative Katko from New York, as well as Representative Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania. So two Republicans. In fact, I think that bill now has more Republicans than Democrats. So there are Republicans out there that are supportive of Medicaid, and you know, we appreciate working with them. Certainly, we have had our issues in the past with the previous administration in terms of some of the changes they wanted to make to Medicaid during the repeal and replace debate. But there are certainly wonderful Republicans out there that understand the importance of Medicaid to their population, to the economy of their region, and to our country.
All right. So for the next question, how did the ACA affect your organization and the plans you represent? Was it a sea of change? Or for you, your organization and your members, was its effect more on margin? And has the main effect been Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, I think there's three things I can say about the importance of the Affordable Care Act to our association, our plans, and there's a kind of a couple or a triplet, I guess. We helped pen it, we defended it, and we're hoping to amend it. And so in terms of the penning it, we were very involved in the passage and support. Our plans, again, were up lobbying in support of the Affordable Care Act in 09 and 10. And there was a provision in there related to what is known as the Drug Rebate Equalization Act. And it was the legislation that required that the Medicaid rebate program be applied to expenditures in managed care as well as in fee-for-service in Medicaid. And that was a significant saver to the federal government that helped pay for the expansion. So that was really kind of a major watershed for ACAP in terms of we had been pushing this proposal for many years. We thought that the fact that states could not get the rebates for expenditures in Medicaid managed care was leading a lot of plans to carve out drugs from managed care. And we believe that that was deleterious to individuals because a health plan needs to be able to look at the whole person. And certainly drugs are such a big part of healthcare, and for plans not to have control over that part of the spending and get that data on a real-time basis, we felt was not good for individuals. And so that passed, and within literally a month, several states, they were moving towards rolling drugs out of managed care, including Massachusetts, decided not to do it. Mm-hmm. So that was a big piece. And so I would say that that's what we helped pin in the Affordable Care Act. And then certainly in 2017, we helped defend it. And we're very involved. Our board actually spearheaded a campaign called Medicaid Is Us, and they spent over $1 million on ads on radio, TV, and Facebook, promoting the importance of Medicaid, that Medicaid is for working people, that it allows people to work. And that campaign resulted in over 50,000 messages to Congress saying, don't repeal Medicaid. So we were very proud of the work that was done there and the board's commitment. As I said, it was over $1 million campaign. It was a major, major investment for our association, and it really paid off. And now we are helping to amend it. We've never said the Affordable Care Act is perfect. It's certainly good, could be better. And so we are now working to one, we want the non-expansion states, the dirty dozen, as I've learned they're called, to take up the expansion. And there's certainly a lot of goodies in the last bill that got passed. I don't know that the states are going to take it up, unfortunately. We'd also like to see, in terms of the marketplace, those subsidies expanded and made permanent as they were just done. But the changes to the subsidies are only for 2 years, and we'd like to see them made permanent. So those are just some of the changes we'd like to see, as well as I already mentioned the continuous eligibility provision in Medicaid that we've been working on that, we think that would strengthen the Medicaid program. It's very hard to work on improving people's quality of care if they're going on and off Medicaid, even though they probably are still eligible, but because of administrative issues, they're losing their eligibility temporarily.
Let's pause and just discuss the Dirty Dozen a little bit and Medicaid expansion. So they're, you know, they've tried to sweeten it for those states, and there may or may not be takers. So, you know, there's been even proposals from Zeke Emanuel, if it comes to mind, that perhaps we need to move to nationalize Medicaid. You know, as you know, it was sort of thrown in to Medicare in 65, you know, with and it was the idea that it be a state by state thing was a compromise. I guess I'm just wondering what if that's the nut to crack. What are your thoughts on how to complete Medicaid expansion, which after all, in the ACA, you know, when the ACA was written before the court decision, it was supposed to be done on a national basis. So what are your thoughts on the expanding to those 12 states?
Well, we were certainly supportive of the change in the law that would have given them, actually, I think it's 90% for all their other Medicaid lives in addition to the expansion. I mean, it's an incredible bargain for states. So we are certainly we were supportive of that provision. We don't lobby at the state level, so we don't get involved in that, but we at the national level, we're supportive of it. And but we think that, you know, there's, I think, there's 2.2 million people that might get coverage if those 30 dozen took it up. And that's obviously, that's extremely important, but there's 10 million people that are currently eligible in the other states and don't have Medicaid yet. And so that's why we have been pushing for the 12-month continuous eligibility, again, to keep people on. And also very interested in the ideas behind auto enrollment. I'm actually on an advisory board in Maryland, where Maryland is experimenting with asking people on the tax forms, do you have health insurance or do you want information on health insurance? And using the information on the tax forms, they can reach out to people in the marketplace to see if they want to enroll, or put their, if they're on Medicaid, by looking at the income levels, they can get them enrolled in Medicaid. So, and that has been pretty successful in Maryland so far in terms of just, you know, educating more people about the marketplace. And certainly there's a lot of chitter chatter now about whether that could be done at the federal level. So, so I think that we need to focus as much on the people that are already eligible but not enrolled. There's a lot more of them than there are in the expansion states, but, you know, clearly we need to get the 30 dozen to support the people in their states and get them health insurance.
Just by way of emphasis, how many, and I think you maybe just mentioned this, but how many people are eligible for Medicaid in the expansion states who have not enrolled in it versus the dirty dozen? I mean, are there more lives to be covered? Is there more gain on the system available in the expansion states?
Yeah, there's more people not enrolled in the current states that have taken it up than are would be eligible in the dirty dozen, as we call them. So just in terms of where we put our emphasis and our energy, there's a lot more bang for the buck in the focusing on that, but which is not to say that we shouldn't focus on the Florida and Texas. We need to get them in. That's where the lives are for the non-expansion states.
Thank you. All right. So for another question, last year a spotlight was put on healthcare inequity and racism. So how did your organization respond to that? And do you think there will be a fundamental change to address these issues, or was it just reactive?
Well, I certainly hope so, obviously. We in ACAP have been working on these issues in some ways since the beginning. Obviously, the more people have health insurance, the more equity there can be. Although even people who have health insurance, clearly we know that there's inequities there. So we had done a fact sheet recently looking at what our plans were doing. And one of the things that came out was just the problems with the data, that you can't measure what you can't, you know, doesn't matter if you can't measure it or whatever the saying is. So we are working with our plans to try to help them get the data in terms of race and ethnicity. There was an example in Connecticut, I think they told us that if people didn't give their ethnicity, they were just defaulted to being white. And so when people looked at the data, they said that the numbers just didn't look right in terms of the percentage of the white population. And then they went back and found out. And that I think is kind of an example of the systematic racism, that the default is white. Whereas we know that that's really not true, and increasingly not true in this country. So that's one of the things that we are looking at, is how can we get better data? And our plans certainly work on that. When anytime they have a touch point with clients, they ask them those questions. Some people want to answer, some people don't. But the ACA did include a requirement that this data be collected, but it was not funded. And so that's one of the things we're calling for, is some additional funding to help states collect the data. So that's one issue, is just the data issue. And then certainly whatever our plans are doing, we are always trying to share best practices through roundtables and documenting it in fact sheets. And then we're also working to promote and enhance the workforce in our plans. We have a leadership academy for 20 people each year that work in our plans. These are kind of mid-levels, up-and-comers, and we certainly encourage plans to reach out to the BIPOC population, and it's a very diverse group of people in that. So we're always looking for stars that we can highlight. So those are some of the types of things we're doing. We also are working on the creation, and this is a little... precursor of things that hopefully maybe you'll focus on when this rolls out. But we'd like to have a blueprint for health equity at ACAP, and which would include a learning collaborative, some workforce issues, and then some policies that would promote equity. So that's just a teaser for something to come that we'll come back to you on. But our plans have always been dedicated to these issues, so we'll continue to work on it and spotlighting it and trying to weave it through everything we do at ACAP and within the plans.
So this is Peter again. In terms of equity and racism, so we've had these Medicaid plans, but you know, Medicaid coverage historically hasn't meant that you have the same sort of access to healthcare and the same sort of access to providers that a person who had commercial insurance. The network was narrower, the reimbursement rate to providers was lower, so many providers don't take Medicaid patients. So I just wonder whether you see that as a reflection of these equity issues, and equity being a bit of a euphemism for racism in many cases, and whether they're being addressed. To sort of put that in a tighter question, has Medicaid, even if you have it, really limited your access to providers? And because of who's covered by Medicaid, it's sort of we end up with a system that's not racially equal.
Well, Medicaid is certainly, since the expansion passed, there have been so many articles showing the importance of Medicaid in terms of better prenatal care, better birth outcomes, more people getting better care for their diabetes, less bankruptcy. You know, one issue is what you compare Medicaid to, and certainly if you compare it to being uninsured, it's much, much better. And so that's one of the issues that I think we have to think about. But we have always been calling for Medicaid to be funded fairly. We do have the actuarial soundness requirement in federal law, and that, you know, our plans can only pay out what we're given by the states. And so it's very important that the federal government enforce actuarial soundness and that the states themselves negotiate fairly. And it's particularly an issue for the safety net health plans, because many of our plans only have one client, and that is the state Medicaid program. So we don't have anywhere to go. We know that the Centenes and the Uniteds of the world do pull out of states when the rates are not to their liking. But our plans can't, because they only have one client, and also they're mission driven. Their purpose is to serve this population. So we have always called on the states to treat our plans fairly, because we're there for the long run. We're not going anywhere.
Now, what policies or program would you like to see the Biden administration implement or advance? And are you pleased with the administration so far?
So we are pleased with the administration so far. Some of the things that we did not approve of, they've overturned, like the Section 1557 discrimination regulation, the work requirements. Just today they announced rolling back some of those. I've already mentioned the continuous eligibility, that they supported the provision that allows states to do 12-month continuous eligibility for postpartum women, which is great. Obviously, we want them to go further. So they have really been very supportive of Medicaid. We are waiting for them to announce a regulation to roll back the Trump administration's regulations on junk insurance. Many of your listeners and readers may know that we have led the charge against junk insurance. We think that the short-term limited duration plans do have a place in the market, but they should be short-term and of limited duration, which means in our mind, 3 months. And so we're waiting on the administration and calling on the administration to release that regulation, because if they don't do it soon, these things will still be being sold in 22, during the open market. We know that people sometimes erroneously and sometimes fraudulently are pushed towards junk insurance plans without really understanding what they're buying. And yes, they're cheaper, and that there's a reason for that, and it's because they don't offer really comprehensive essential coverage in the words of the Affordable Care Act. So that is one thing we are calling on the administration, and they have certainly Secretary Becerra has certainly given a nod. We know it's on their list, but we'd like to move it up so that we don't have these things proliferating in 22.
Got it. Thank you. Now, should the provisions of the American Rescue Plan that increase subsidies and eligibility to be made permanent, should they be? And how did those provisions affect your members?
We do think that they should be made permanent. I mentioned the 2 years for the subsidies. We're calling on that to be made permanent. In fact, our members were up just like 2 or 3 weeks ago on virtually on Capitol Hill, asking their members to make it permanent. The postpartum continuous eligibility also is time limited. So we're calling on that one also to be made permanent. We think that's kind of a no-duh that women should have coverage postpartum, not just for 60 days, but for a full year. And we're hoping that some of these will move through reconciliation. So our plans will continue to be making their calls to members of Congress, reminding them how many people in Medicaid, how many people in their district they have on Medicaid, as I mentioned, with our new data. So we're hoping that there will be movement with the reconciliation package that as of today seems like it's getting some traction based on what we heard from the president last night.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.